I met a salesman in a Parker house. His name was Dave Singelman. He was 84 years old, and he drummed merchandise in 31 states. And old Dave would go up to his room, you understand, and put on his green velvet slippers, I'll never forget, and he would pick up the phone and call the buyers. And without ever leaving his room, at the age of 84, he made his living. And when I saw that, I realized that selling was the greatest career a man could have. Because what could be more satisfying than to be able to go at the age of 84 into 20, 30 different cities and pick up the phone and be remembered and loved and helped by so many different people? Do you know when he died, and by the way, he died the death of a salesman, in his green velvet slippers and a smoker of the New York, New Haven, Hartford, going into Boston. When he died, hundreds of salesmen and buyers were at his funeral. Things were sad on a lot of trains for months after that.
That's Willie Loman from Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Arthur Miller's play gives us the final days of an aging salesman looking back over his life and his frustrating quest for the American dream. It won the 1949 Pulitzer Prize for Drama, Tony Award for Best Play, and New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Play. As novelist Joyce Carol Oates writes, "Willie Loman is all of us. Death of a Salesman strikes us as the most achingly contemporary of our classic American plays." The Madison Repertory Theater has opened its season with Death of a Salesman, running now through October 14th. Joining us in the studio is Richard Corley, Artistic Director of the Madison Repertory Theater and the Director of Death of a Salesman. And with him are two cast members, Roderick Peoples as Willie Loman and one of his sons, Biff, played by Braden Moran.
Welcome one and all to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thank you, Norman. Thank you.
Rick, you actually have met Arthur Miller, I guess, on several occasions, got to know him a little bit. Did that affect at all the way you approached this play?
Well, it affected the way I approached the play because when I worked with Miller a little bit, it was a production of a play of his called Broken Glass, and it was the first production after the New York production. And what he wanted to talk about, which has really stuck with me, is that he felt that that production of his play, Broken Glass, was misguided, that in fact his work was not seen in the way he wanted it to be seen often. He was sort of thought of as a realist, and in fact he's not a realist. He's someone who was very much interested in consciousness and time and a sort of fluidity of states of being. And he wanted his plays to be told like stories. He wanted storytelling to be paramount in the theater, and he wanted to do away with the trappings of realism. So he encouraged me to do that particular play, Broken Glass, in a very much a storytelling mode. And I had all the actors on stage for the whole play, and they stood up and did the play in front of the audience. And there was a very, very spare and beautifully simple form to that. And that certainly influenced the way we're doing this play, which is very much on a bare stage, very simply done, and I think very much in keeping with how he originally saw the work. He originally saw Death of a Salesman as a play about the exploding fragments of a man's consciousness in the moments before his death. And at the time, nobody had written a play like that. It was revolutionary. And he wrote the first act of the play in one night. And it's often been said, spent the rest of his career figuring out how he did that. But that time I spent with him really did have a great influence over my thinking about his work because he was very clear about what he thought it was and what it wasn't.
Well, it seems Death of a Salesman has a place in American theater along with maybe Glass Menagerie and Long Day's Journey Into Night as one of those absolute chestnuts or classics. Are there challenges in terms of staging a play that has that kind of iconic status?
Well, sure. I guess there are challenges in that you want to really do what I hope we always do in the theater, which is to try and go back to the original impulse that the play came from and not be influenced by the accretion of history, the patina of historical weight around the play, but really look at the play as freshly as you can. And I think as much as we can, we've tried to do that, to simply, as we say in the theater, you know, make ourselves as dumb as possible. You know, do a ton of research, read everything you possibly can on the play.
And then forget it.
And then forget it. Sit down with the script and just discover it and say, what is this trying to do? What is this trying to say? And so that is a challenge with the play. But on the other hand, and I don't know what this says about the educational system in America, but it's surprising how many people don't know the play. It hasn't been done in Madison in 22 years, and it's just it's astonishing to me how many people I meet and people on my staff and the company of actors meet, run into in Madison, who say, yeah, you know, I think I read that in high school, but I've never seen it on stage, or I've never experienced it or whatever. And I think, oh, my goodness. You know.
Well, I've seen All My Sons by Arthur Miller, and this one, too, seems really focused on the father-son relationship. Is that because of Miller's own, something from his own life?
Absolutely. The essential relationship in Arthur Miller's life was with his father. And the story of his relationship with his father, if you look at that story, you get to the heart of everything he wrote about. Miller's father was the owner of the Miltex coat factory. That was a huge women's coat factory, and he was very wealthy. They lived on the upper floors of a brownstone on Central Park North, and they lived in great luxury. His father was a Jewish immigrant from Eastern Europe. Then the Depression hit. His father lost everything in the Depression and became a salesman for the company he had owned.
Bingo.
And so Miller found himself going from looking at a man who was heroic in his eyes, who was not only, you know, the breadwinner, but a very, very successful breadwinner, to moving in with his they all moved in with his mother's family in Brooklyn and Red Hook. His father was humiliated, and his mother, to her discredit, often berated the father for not being successful anymore and sort of blamed him, in a sense, for not being able to work in the Depression. That happened a lot with men. So if you look at that story, what you see is, you know, a relationship between a father and a son fraught with tension and emotion, and at the same time, the conflation of a father's failure with the failure of a nation. And there you have Arthur Miller.
It's an interesting time. Of course, he's looking back at the Depression, but he's writing this in 1949. Is there anything that says of 1949 about it?
Well, I think it's extraordinary, Norman, that he wrote this in 1949 because, of course, we're coming off World War II, the post-war boom, and the post-war sort of
a certain kind of euphoria, in a way.
Euphoria and enormous success. I mean, all of a sudden, America was richer than just about every country in the world combined. And here's this play in 1949, which is saying the American dream is really flawed. And the fact that it had such an enormous effect on people, I think, was partly that, you know, you had these men coming back from the war whose fathers had been those men in the Depression. Or the men in the Depression coming back, or you know, there, it was still a close enough time that all of that was true. But also, why does it resonate today? It's an iconic story, and Arthur Miller considered it the heroic story of a man who refuses to allow himself to be dehumanized. You know, that Willie stands up for himself as a man, and as a unique man in the context of the dehumanization of society, and arguably, of course, that's only gotten far worse in the intervening years. So it stays not only enormously relevant, but I think gets more and more and more relevant. And maybe Willie comes to be seen not as, you know, the failure, but as the hero, the man who says, I won't be marginalized and told I'm nothing.
Rereading it, I was struck by nature and how little of it there is. You know, a lot of it has to do with wanting to plant seeds or Biff wanting to get out in the open air or memories of lilacs and wisteria. How do you show that in the play?
It's one of the major themes of the play, this tension between the industrialization of one's environment and the sort of romantic dream of the American wilderness. And what we did what we started with was that realization that that was one of the major themes of the play. And the set by Brian Bembridge really reflects that. Not only do you have a central sort of arena area, which is all made up of steel grating, like a subway steel grating, surrounded by linoleum tile and on a huge rake, a vast rake. And then above that, at the top of the rake, these enormous columns, 18-foot columns, which are printed with an Ansel Adams photograph of the mountains in the west and a river running through it. And then they're also light boxes. So lit at a certain way, they look like skyscrapers. A certain way, they look like this black and white image of the American West. And a certain way, they look like sort of forbidding parts of the landscape. So that tension between what we have been told is the romantic view of nature in American life and the sense of freedom that that implies, and the way that everything is closing in, Willie's speech about the, you know, the apartment houses closing in on either side and no room to breathe and all of that, is so much a part of the play.
The way they boxed us in here with bricks and windows and bricks, the streets are lined with cars. There's not a breath of fresh air in the neighborhood. The grass don't grow anymore. You can't raise a carrot in the backyard. They should have had a law against building those apartment houses. You remember those two beautiful elm trees out there when I and Biff hung the swing between them? Oh, they should have arrested the builder for cutting those down. They massacred the neighborhood. Oh, more and more I think of those days, Linda. This time of year there'd be lilac and wisteria, and then the peonies would come and the daffodils. Oh, what fragrance in this room.
Well, it's a man who does have some bit of a green thumb, though, doesn't he?
Yes.
It's not just dreaming.
No, absolutely. He had that connection. His father was a part of the prairie world, and there is that connection and that sense of wanting to go back to something that actually you can get your hands into, something that you can hold on to. That's another theme of the play. You know, Willie's life is spent with appointments and promises, and in a sense, what is he selling? You never find out in the play what he's selling. He's selling himself. He's selling his smile. He's selling the way that he presents himself to the world.
Selling his soul, too, in a way.
Yes. And so the idea of having something to hold on to, the idea of finding gold in Alaska or something, that's real. That's true. And yet in America we're told, just be likable, you know, and everybody will like you. And just, you know, that's all you have.
This has some great resonance with, you know, I almost think of it in a way as the Great Gatsby of the 40s. Or of the Grapes of Wrath of the 40s. I mean, this whole thing about you're losing your connection.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that gets back to what we're talking about the war. You know, the more urbanized and industrialized and booming a society is, the more there's this nostalgia for something simple. And that's a part of this play, certainly.
Can you talk about Biff and his dream of sort of the West and how that fits in?
Biff is a man who really was taught at an early age to have certain ideals about life and to think of himself as heroic, and his life is an epic kind of life. And when he finds that he's not able to do that, he's lost, and he finds himself out in the West exploring that world in the West, but finding himself unable to get hold of anything that really makes him feel satisfied. So in the play, he's come back to Brooklyn and to his family at a crisis. He's 32 years old. He doesn't know what he wants to do, and he's searching for something. And what he's really searching for is his relationship with his father, and to find some way of understanding that and coming to some new understanding with his father that would allow him to move on in a productive way.
Hap, I've had 20 or 30 different kinds of jobs since I left home before the war, and it always turns out the same. I just realized it lately, in Nebraska when I herded cattle, and the Dakotas, and Arizona, and now in Texas. It's why I came home now, I guess, because I realized it. This farm I work on, it's spring there now, see, and they've got about 15 new colts, and there's nothing more inspiring or beautiful than the sight of a mare and a new colt. And it's cool there now. See, Texas is cool now, and it's spring. And whenever spring comes to where I am, I suddenly get the feeling, my God, I'm not getting anywhere. What the hell am I doing, playing around with horses, $28 a week? I'm 34 years old. I ought to be making my future. That's when I come running home. And now I get here, and I don't know what to do with myself. I've always made a point of not wasting my life, and every time I come back here, I know that all I've done is to waste my life.
Biff's problem stems from his relationship with his father. Boy, this is fun to get into this Freudian stuff, but it's not much of a stretch to do so with this particular play. He needs, at one point, he's failed a math course back in school. And that really is the beginning of the end for him, not the failure of the course, but the failure with his father to overcome that problem or somehow deal with it. And he actually has a real moment of crisis when he comes to ask his father for some help or advice. And this points to Willie Loman as not just a victim in this thing. He's also definitely part of the problem.
Yes, he is. The biggest part of the problem is that his son was taught not to think of him as a man, but to think of him as a heroic icon. And then when it is revealed that he is very much a man, a flawed man, a lonely man, a man who can, on the road under great stress and loneliness, be with someone other than Biff's mother, everything comes crashing down because everything has been built up to such a degree that it can't withstand any scrutiny. And that's part of what the play is saying. This is a great theme of American drama. O'Neill deals with it a great deal. Miller does. Williams, too, to some extent. The idea that our illusions, our dreams, our, as O'Neill puts it, pipe dreams, are so essential to us and yet keep us from being authentically who we need to be and want to be. So,
and set us up for a fall.
Set us up for an enormous fall. And yet, that's the stuff of great tragedy and great drama. And I think obviously if I was asked the other day by someone, Willie's really deluded, right? And I said, yeah, but great delusion is the stuff of great drama. You don't make a great drama about a man who says, oh, it's nice to retire and go play golf in Florida.
King Lear is deluded, too.
That's exactly right. He does, and Willie, just like Lear, does not accept. He has no sense of acceptance or resignation about his life. He is fighting and fighting and fighting until the end. And again, Arthur Miller thought that that was heroic and wonderful to some degree. And the truth will out, as they say in Shakespeare.
Well, like Lear, Willie also has this moment of rage in the wilderness. For Lear, it actually is wilderness. For Willie, it's in a men's room.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's a very, very poignant moment in the play. And again, Miller was taken to task by some people who said, oh, you know, this can't be a tragedy. And Miller said, what do you mean? Because, like, he has his moment in the men's room, a tragic moment in the men's, you know, instead of on the heath. Those things are just the outward trappings. The core of a tragedy is someone desiring greatness and failing, and what we learn from that, well, the catharsis we have from that. But you know, our Willie Rick has played King Lear, so he can probably speak to that more than me.
Oh, what am I supposed to say? What to say?
Well, I would love to hear about your characterization of Willie Loman compared to Lear.
Well, there are so many similarities. We've been talking about it throughout rehearsal, particularly in the way that we're staging this play, because it's a very non-traditional, at least in terms of Death of a Salesman, very non-traditional way to approach the staging of the play. It's much more Shakespearean in nature because it's a big open stage, and the structure of the play is very fluid. They're just like Shakespeare's very fluid, you know, it just sort of moves from one scene into another, from one idea and one group of people to another seamlessly. And so there are a lot of similarities between it. There's a similarity in the way we stage the end of the play, which is differs a little bit from the way that it's written in the edition that everybody reads. It's much more like the way Lear ends. And I don't know. It's quite touching in a way. I mean, I've got to say, I was talking to somebody about it the other day. I actually think Willie's more difficult to play. Maybe that says something about the way I played Lear.
Well, with
but
Lear,
I'm actually finding it more challenging to play Willie. I don't know.
It's well, just, with Lear, you start out with a king, and then you have a basket case at the end.
Yeah.
In other words, you couldn't fall much farther.
Well, the challenges are very different. I mean, Lear has this incredibly extreme range. It's like climbing the Himalayas. You know, it's so vast in scale, really, emotional scale. But Willie is intense. I mean, Willie has this and an extreme polarity of emotions. He can go on a single page of the script from an acute anxiety attack to having a big belly laugh with somebody, you know. But I guess what's challenging about Willie is just following all the nuances. In Lear, the role is sort of brushed with big, big strokes, and it's a matter of scale. It's just hard to fill that huge role, you know. A real human being trying to fill that kind of mythic role is always the challenge. Here, Willie is such a human being. I mean, he's a real guy, and he has these incredibly nuanced trains of thought that are just incredibly challenging to try and elucidate, you know, as you move through the play.
And we're going to hear more from Death of a Salesman when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
We're always interested in hearing what you think about our programming. Please write to us with your comments at Audience Services, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison 53706.
Willie?
It's all right. I came back.
Why? What happened? Did something happen,
no,
Willie?
No, nothing happened.
You didn't smash the car, did you?
I said nothing happened, didn't you hear me?
Don't you feel well?
I'm tired to the death. I couldn't make it. I just couldn't make it, Linda.
Where were you all day? You looked terrible.
I got as far as a little above Yonkers. Stopped for a cup of coffee. Maybe it was a coffee.
What?
I suddenly couldn't drive anymore. Car kept going off onto the shoulder, you know?
Oh, maybe it was the steering again. I don't think Angelo knows the Studebaker.
No, it's me, it's me. Suddenly I realize I'm going 60 miles an hour, and I don't remember the last 5 minutes. I can't seem to keep my mind to it.
Maybe it's your glasses. You never went for your new glasses.
No, I see everything. I came back 10 miles an hour. It took me nearly 4 hours from Yonkers.
That's the opening of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Richard Corley, artistic director of the Madison Repertory Theater. In that opening scene, you heard Roderick Peoples as Willie Loman and Patricia Boyette as his wife, Linda. Also in the studio with us is Braden Moran as the son, Biff. Rick, in that famous opening scene from Death of a Salesman, where Willie and Linda are talking, what is it that we're supposed to learn right off the bat in that opening minute of the play?
Arthur Miller didn't want any lead-in to the story. He wanted you to be placed right in the middle of the situation, and he wanted to tell you right from the beginning what was going to happen. So right in the first few moments of the play, you see a man who's lost his way, was driving, didn't know where he was, had to come back from a trip, essentially a man suffering a nervous breakdown. And you see that right at the beginning of the play. And he wanted you to know all of that. Of course, the title of the play tells you what's going to happen in the play. So he wanted you to know all of that so that then you would set aside, in a sense, for yourself that question of which we like to ask so much when we see something, you know, what's going to be the outcome, and focus on the details of how it comes about and focus on the deterioration of his mind and the kind of extraordinary way he's trying to hold himself together, and his wife Linda's trying to help him do that. So right away, you're placed in the middle of his dilemma.
to get back to the biographical, which I don't like to do too much, but it seems tempting here. You mentioned that Miller's own mother really was a goad for his father, gave him kind of a rough time. It seems the wife here could almost be played either way, just from the lines, but she sounds more sympathetic.
She's very, very supportive of Willie, and they have a real partnership, a real marriage. She's much harder on the sons, as having failed to support him as he's gotten older and has begun to be unable to be the man that he was. But I think that, you know, I think that she's a real rock in the family, and she really sees herself in that way, and she's the one who utters the famous lines, "Attention must be paid." She just feels that he's been an extraordinary man in his life, and at the end of it, he's not, as she says, to be thrown into his grave like an old dog. And so she's a powerhouse in the play, and it is very different from Miller's own mother. The women in Miller's plays are complex, and he's often thought of as a more or less a purely masculine writer. And certainly his obsession is with men and sons and fathers, but the women I find to be complex and extraordinary in his plays.
It fascinates me. This is a total red herring, but it does fascinate me that he married Marilyn Monroe. It's almost hard to reconcile the two ways of thinking.
Well, I think. Well, you had it came at a particular time. He was already married. He had a family, a pretty large family, and they met through Elia Kazan. And I think it was a kind of a dazzling thing. He had gotten very famous. He was actually, you know, he'd actually written this play and The Crucible, and he was very, very successful and very famous, and, of course, so was she. It didn't last, of course, and it brings up a lot of questions about private morality and public persona that have been continue to resonate lately with the revelation that Miller had a son with Down syndrome that he put in a home and didn't really have much to do with in his life. I mean, to my mind, any adult over the age of 18 understands that there's oftentimes an enormous contradiction between who we are privately and who we are publicly, and that that's just the way of the world. And I think he was extraordinary as an artist and also as someone who stood up for human rights, his leadership of Penn and all of that. And privately, not so much sometimes.
A little like Willie Loman that way, too.
That's right. Had those secrets. That's right. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, maybe we could hear a little more of Willie Loman and his wife from that opening scene.
Well, you'll just have to take a rest, Willie. You can't continue this way.
I just got back from Florida.
But you didn't rest your mind. Your mind is overactive, and the mind is what counts, dear.
I'll start out in the morning. Maybe I'll feel better in the morning. These goddamn arch supports are killing me.
Take an aspirin. Should I get you an aspirin? It'll soothe you.
I was driving along, you understand, and I was fine. I was even observing the scenery. You can imagine me looking at scenery on the road every week of my life. But it's so beautiful up there, Linda. Trees are so thick and the sun is warm. I opened the windshield and just let the warm air bathe over me. And then all of a sudden I'm going off the road. I'm telling you, I absolutely forgot I was driving. If I'd gone the other way over the white line, I might have killed somebody. So I went on again, and 5 minutes later I'm dreaming again, and I nearly... I have such thoughts. I have such strange thoughts.
Willie, dear... Talk to them again. There's no reason why you can't work in New York.
They don't need me in New York. I'm the New England man. I'm vital in New England.
But you're 60 years old. They can't expect you to keep traveling every week.
I have to send a wire to Portland. I'm supposed to see Brown and Morrison tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock to show the line. God damn it, I could sell them.
Why don't you go down to the place tomorrow and tell Howard you've simply got to work in New York? You're too accommodating, dear.
You mentioned that Miller does seem obsessed with the father-son relationship. Can you give us a sample of Willie Loman and his two sons?
Yes, there's a scene toward the end of the play where Willie is out in the garden planting. This is in the middle of the night, and Biff comes out to say goodbye to him.
Where the hell is that seed? I can't see a thing out here. Boxed in the whole goddamn neighborhood.
There are people all around here. Don't you realize that?
Don't bother me. I'm busy.
I'm saying goodbye to you, Pop. I'm not coming back anymore.
You're not going to see Oliver tomorrow?
I've got no appointment, Dad.
He put his arm around you and you've got no appointment.
Pop, get this now, will you? Every time I've left, it's been a fight that sent me out of here. Today, I realized something about myself, and I tried to explain it to you, and I think I'm just not smart enough to make any sense out of it for you. To hell with whose fault it is or anything like that. Let's just wrap it up, huh? Come on in. We'll tell Mom.
No, I don't want to see her.
Come on.
No, I don't want to see her.
Why don't you want to see her?
Don't bother me, will you?
What do you mean you don't want to see her? You don't want them calling you yellow, do you? This isn't your fault. It's me. I'm a bum. Now come inside. Did you hear what I said to you?
Did you plant, dear?
All right. We had it out. I'm going and I'm not writing anymore.
I think that's the best way, dear, because there's no use drawing it out. You'll just never get along.
People ask where I am and what I'm doing. You don't know and you don't care. That way it'll be off your mind and you can start brightening up again. All right? That clears it, doesn't it? You gonna wish me luck, Scout? What do you say?
Shake his hand, Willie.
There's no necessity to mention the pen at all, you know.
I've got no appointment, Dad.
He put his arm around...
Dad, you're never going to see what I am, so what's the use of arguing? If I strike oil, I'll send you a check. Meantime, forget I'm alive.
Spite, see?
Shake hands, Dad.
Not my hand.
I was hoping not to go this way.
Well, this is the way you're going. Goodbye. May you rot in hell if you leave this house.
Exactly what is it that you want from me?
I want you to know, on the train, in the mountains, in the valleys, wherever you go, that you cut down your life for spite.
No, no.
Spite. Spite is the word of your undoing. And when you're down and out, I want you to remember what did it. When you're rotting beside the railroad tracks, I want you to remember, and don't you dare blame it on me.
I'm not blaming it on you.
I'm not going to take the rap for this, you hear me?
That's just what I'm telling you.
You're trying to stick a knife in me. Don't think I don't know what you're doing.
Well, I'm tempted to say that this is where Willie starts to get paranoid. Nervous breakdown is one thing. Persecution complex or whatever is something else.
Well, that starts a lot earlier in the play, unfortunately. He thinks the whole world is sort of against him. And, you know, as Linda says, maybe it is. I mean, when you work for a company for 30 years and you're not respected and no one seems to acknowledge everything that you've done, and it's hard. It's hard to feel that you're not being given your due.
I'm curious, Braden, about playing Biff and how you see this character that you do on stage.
As Richard was talking about, one of the very first things you start hearing about Biff is that he's lost. And I think that's a very accurate assessment of who he is at the start of the play. He's 34 years old, and basically his life was bisected at 17. Up to 17, he was the golden boy in his father's eyes and in his very own eyes. He was the quarterback of the football team. He was the cool kid, and he had everything. He had the golden life, and he had a great future ahead of him, and he was bound for greatness. And he'd been told that, and he was prepared for that, and that was the way it was going to be. And then at 17, he confronts the harsh reality, what Richard was talking about. He realizes that his father is a human being, and that therefore if he's created in his father's image, he also must be a human being. And it's that harsh realization that sends him spiraling. Literally for the next 17 years of his life, he moves from that catalyst into a downward spiral of wrangling with who he is after all he's known to be real has been pulled out from underneath him. So he's a drifter in that respect. He drifts around and he bounces around trying to find something true and honest and real to hold on to, something grounded. And he speaks a lot of being in the West and moving around. He has a lot of similarities to Uncle Ben, who is a representation of a lot of those great things, the West and just the joy of being outdoors and the freedom of exploration and achievement. And so he goes out and looks for all that stuff and finds emptiness still. And when he comes back home, it's that It's the sense of what Richard was saying again, that really what he needs is the love of his father. And, of course, he doesn't know that until, you know, page 140. otherwise, we wouldn't have a play. But the dawning realization as we go on through the play is just that he's arriving at a certain sense of truth about himself and about the family. And until he's able to speak that truth, he doesn't feel like he can move anywhere. So it really is about this declaration of self.
I've got to wonder about the other brother. Anytime you have a character named Happy, there's something going on. What's his story?
Well, he didn't have the disillusioning experience that Biff did. He swallowed the whole hook, line, and sinker idea of what Willie has preached and lived. And so as far as Happy's concerned, you know, if he becomes the manager of his department and he does well and he gets a lot of girls and he makes some money, that's the American dream. And yet, Happy also expresses a lot of disillusion with his life and doesn't seem to be satisfied with who he is. I think the problem with both of the sons is that there's no sort of authentic – I mean, never once have they been asked – what do you want? What would fulfill you? And it's all about, you're going to be great, you know? Mm. You're going to be the best. You're going to be, you know, you're going to have it all. You're going to have it all. And that turns one into kind of a corrupt, petty bureaucrat. That's what Happy is, if you want to get right down to brass tacks. Takes bribes and philanders and so on. And then Biff, who, if you want to, again, get down to brass tacks, is a petty thief who thinks that he doesn't have to work for things, that he's entitled. And again, I think these are aspects of what we're taught in America, that we can have everything, that we should have everything. And again, asking who you are and thinking about your authentic self doesn't occur to anyone. Just doesn't occur.
It's kind of interesting in a way, though. I mean, if we're talking about sort of the depression experience,
yes,
depression with a capital D,
yes,
where that question really didn't pertain because it didn't matter what work you like to do. You like to do work that paid and put bread on the table.
That's right. That's right. And that's an honorable thing to do. My father was a mill worker for 40 years and just got up every day and did his job and, you know, and if you asked him why he was doing it, he would say, for you and your sister to sacrifice. The difference between him and Willie was that he also spent a lot of time asking me what I wanted to be, and my sister as well, and really seemed to care about that and not just wanting to, in a sense, make us grandiose in his eyes the way Willie does.
And is it Biff who says the line, "We never told the truth for 10 minutes in this house"?
Yeah. I think that's an earth-shattering sentence because that is probably the first time the truth has been uttered, is that sentence. and all hell breaks loose. I mean, because the real confrontation with that reality is something that has been pushed off for years in the house. And I think part of the pursuit of the American dream is you have to at some level delude yourself that everything is great and that you're going towards something worthwhile. And then as it starts to dawn on you that maybe this isn't exactly what I wanted, you either have to tell yourself that truth or you have to continue to buy into a lie that you've built for yourself. So it's this interesting confrontation with that realization for him. That's what he's realized. And you know, at the end of the play, they say, you know, Willie was a salesman. This was his life. This is who he was. And, you know, Biff says it's all about knowing who you are. And perhaps that was who he was, and their realities will just never make sense together. But that's the confrontation, I think.
I want to ask about a character who isn't in the play, but plays a big part nonetheless, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Rick Corley, who is the director, the artistic director of Death of a Salesman, being produced by the Madison Repertory Theater. Also in our cast, as Willie Loman, Roderick Peoples, and as his son Biff, we have Braden Moran. This is a play, to some extent, it's about role models. Sometimes they have feet of clay, but in the case of one character who's not in the play, a role model, what do we make of the apparently very successful salesman, Dave Singelman? You know, we have all the story of failure and illusion, but what about this shining role model, Dave Singelman, super salesman? What do we do with him?
You want to speak about him, Rick?
Well, the way he's written into the show is just a fabulous, fabulous monologue where that you heard at the top of the show, where he talks about this apocryphal almost salesman. If you really try and picture this guy in your head, it's pretty comical. This is an 84-year-old man who lives in hotel rooms in green velvet slippers and talks on the phone to people. And you know, if you just look at that with open eyes for a second, it's pretty pathetic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not a pretty picture. There's nothing about how he has a family. And, you know, he's just
he's working at 84.
Really old man. He's working at 84 years
name
old.
Is Single Man.
Single Man.
Exactly. Dave Single Man.
Today he'd be on the computer selling.
Yeah, stuff. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But Willie has built him, and who, you know, like so many of the things that Willie talks about, who knows how much of this is real and how much of this is just, as Rick said earlier, an accretion of lies.
Believing what you want to believe.
Yeah, believing what you want to believe and telling the lie often enough that it becomes the truth. But yeah, I mean, he's an extraordinary character. And it's, you know, you only hear about him at the one time in the play. He brings up he talks about him when he's trying to save his own job. That's his defense for why he ought to still be allowed to work for this company. And it's the only time you hear about him. And he's set up as this heroic figure, and he's really so sad.
What he really is for Willie, this epitome of how this job allows you to go into places and know everybody, and
yeah,
you know, and be everyone's friend. That's the idea.
Yeah.
And the scene in which he brings it up is, as Rick just said, you know, he's trying to save his job by saying it's not just a business, because Howard, his boss, says, business is business, Willie. We don't have any place for you anymore, really. And he's saying, yeah, but wait a minute. It's, you know, business is business, but wait a minute. There's this man, and he made friends. And so that's what he sees his job as being. And of course, Miller is saying, well, in America, we say that our job is kind of shining and glorious, and we have the American dream and all of that. But when it comes right down to it, if you need to cut costs, you cut costs. And business is business. And there's those two things in American life, and that, you know, that can't reconcile each other, you know.
And Howard is going to say you're fired in sort of Donald Trump fashion shortly thereafter.
Yeah, that's right.
Which brings a question I want to ask. When I teach modern literature, I sometimes get the complaint, it's so gloomy. 20th century literature always is dark and gloomy and bleak. If you were asked that about Death of a Salesman, you know, where is the relief? Where's the comic relief?
There's a lot of comedy in the play, a lot of funny stuff in the play. And in the scenes from the past, the flashbacks, they're almost 50s sitcom kind of scenes. They're very hopeful and funny in their innocence. And there's one that in Act One where Willie has just come back from a trip and Biff is going to be the rising football star, and his other son Hap is excited, and Willie gets to tell them all about his road trip. And there's a number of those scenes sprinkled through the play which leaven the tragedy itself.
What kind of stage directions does Arthur Miller give you?
He gives very simple and very clear stage directions. And in his plays, they're generally the things that he wrote, as opposed to things that were added later in production. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. And sometimes with, for example, Eugene O'Neill, who oftentimes didn't expect his plays to get done.
didn't bother with those directions.
Well, he did. He did. He actually wrote enormous stage amounts of stage directions because he only expected you to be reading the play. And he wanted you to be able to envision it on the stage. He never expected to be staged. Miller's plays were always staged from All My Sons on, and he knew that would happen. So he's writing pretty much for the actors.
Can you give us a sample of one of those flashback scenes that has a sort of happy sound?
Yes, and in this one, I guess I'll read happy, too.
Did you see the new football I got?
Where'd you get a new ball?
The coach told me to practice my passing.
Oh, and is that so? He gave you the ball, huh?
Well, I borrowed it from the locker room.
Oh, I want you to return that.
I told you he wouldn't like it.
Well, I'm bringing it back.
Well, sure, he's got to practice with a regulation ball, doesn't he? Coach will probably congratulate you on your initiative.
Oh, he keeps congratulating my initiative all the time, Pop.
That's because he likes you. If anybody else took that ball, there'd be an uproar. So, what's the report? Boys, what's the report?
Where'd you go this time, Dad? Gee, we were lonesome for you.
Lonesome, huh?
Missed you every minute.
That's so. Well, I'll tell you a secret, boys. Don't breathe it to a soul. Someday, I'm going to have my own business, and I won't have to leave home anymore.
Like Uncle Charlie, eh?
Oh, bigger than Uncle Charlie, because Charlie's not liked. Well, he's liked, but he's not well-liked.
Right. Where'd you go this time, Dad?
Well, I got on the road, and I went north to Providence. Met the mayor.
The mayor of Providence?
He was sitting in the hotel lobby.
What did he say?
He said, morning. And I said, you got a fine city here, mayor. And then he had coffee with me. And then on to Waterbury. Waterbury's a fine city. Big clock city. Famous Waterbury clocks. Old and ice bill there. And then Boston. Boston is the cradle of the revolution. Fine city. And a couple other towns in Mass, and then on to Portland and Binger and straight home.
Gee, I'd love to go with you sometime, Dad.
Soon as summer comes.
Promise?
You and Hap and I'll show you all the towns. America's full of beautiful towns and fine, upstanding people. And they know me, boys. They know me up and down New England, the finest people. And when I bring you fellas up, they'll be open sesame for all of us. Because one thing, boys, I have friends. I can park my car in any street in New England, and the cops protect it like their own.
Flashback or faulty memory?
I think it's pretty accurate, but it's embellished probably a little in Willie's mind. Yeah. It's attained an autumnal a patina of golden haze as all of these memories have.
You know, one of the things that you were saying before about, you know, how is it lightened? How is the drama lightened? I think, you know, there is these moments of joy and there's a lot of humor sprinkled throughout. But I was reading Miller one time actually said, too, about his plays that he leaves this ending where it's almost like a litmus test for your take on humanity, where you can see the gloom and you can see the doom of 20th century or 21st century nowadays drama. Or he said he always leaves this glimmer of hope, and it's a matter of what the audience wants to take out of it. And for the most part, most human beings want to see that grain of hope, and they will find it in the play. And it is there at the very end. It brings
it's
you so
expressed
down,
by Biff.
Yeah, and it is very much the sense of, I know who I am now after this amazing journey that we've gone on together. I know who I am, and now I have a sense of where I can go and what I can do. But it is there. It's just, you know.
In a sense, Willie's death has freed Biff to be the man he needs to be. And in some respects, that's a very primal myth that you in a sense have to kill the father to become who you are going to be. Hopefully you can do it metaphorically in life and not have to do it literally. But Biff does find himself by the end of the play.
How does the mother change in this play? Does she reveal something that we hadn't seen at the beginning?
I think she's at the end of the play. The deepest part of the play for me is embedded in Linda, because Linda gets to utter the final lines of the play. And the final lines of the play are questions. And I often tell casts when we're working on a play, I say, you know, plays don't make statements. They don't tell us things. They ask us questions. And you can define a play's greatness by the size of the questions that it asks. And Linda just stands there at the end of the play and says, why? Why? And, you know, that he allowed her to be the one to ask that question. and that he allowed her to not know the answer at the end and not to try to put it into some sort of a box or say this is what Willie was or so on, I think leaves the audience with that question which reverberates out from the play. So I don't know how much as a character she changes, but I do know that she has an extraordinarily important function in the play.
I'm trying to remember, is there a little bit where she stops coloring her hair? Is that in this play?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, she's a realist.
She's gone gray.
She is a realist, you know, and again, I think that's there to show what a realist she is. She's the one who keeps the household accounts. She's the one who says, we owe this amount of money on this day. There's a great scene where Willie comes in and says, I made thousands and thousands of dollars. And she says, oh, that's wonderful. How much did you make? And then it sort of gets whittled down. He says, I made this much. And she says, oh, that's very good. And he says, well, how much did you really make? And then when it turns out what he really made, she says, oh, that's very good. That's good. That's good. Of course, they have enormous, you know, bills that they can't really pay. But she's very realistic. And Biff says, your hair went gray. And she says, it's been gray since high school. I just stopped coloring it. And he says, well, color it again. I don't want my pal looking old. I mean, you know, it's a family of men who want to remain boys. And she's a very down-to-earth, realistic person in the play and just says this is the way things are.
And it certainly has the power of truth, this play. I want to thank Richard Corley for being our guest and also Roderick Peoples and Braden Moran. It's been a pleasure.
You. Thank you very much.
And we'll have a link to the Madison Repertory Theater on our website at University of the Air.
The production, Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller, our topic this hour. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.